All right, Natasha, thank you so much for coming on the show. We're talking about this unusual radio transient object that you found or that you're investigating earlier this year. So before we start off, what is a radio transient?
Thanks, Cameron. It's great to be here. So a radio transient is a radio source in the sky that comes and then it goes. And there've actually been quite a few discovered over the last 8 decades of radio astronomy. But often what happens is the radio source arrives, we see it with our telescopes, and then it disappears, and that's it. That's all the information we have, is there was a mysterious source, appeared and it went. And what's really amazing about the object that we've discovered is that we have 70 different pulses from this object. So we've managed to measure that radio transient 70 times across a whole range of different radio frequencies, and we've been able to line up those pulses. And unlike some of the other radio transients which have been discovered, where they just appear and disappear at sort of an irregular rate, these ones, if you line them up with a period of 1,091.169 seconds, which is about 18 minutes, they all line up, which is very spooky and very exciting.
Why is it spooky and exciting?
So we know kind of what radio transients are supposed to look like in the sky. There's things like fast radio transients. So these are things like pulsars, which are these compact neutron stars with powerful magnetic fields, and they spin once a second or even faster. And we've been studying pulsars since they were discovered by Jocelyn Bell in 1967. And things like fast radio bursts, which were only discovered about 10 years ago, and we still don't know what they are, but they happen really quickly over a millisecond or so. And there's slow transients. So, for instance, a supernova might explode, and the shockwave takes decades to propagate outward into space. And we can pick up that, and we can see that change over a very long period of time. So, there's fast and there's slow. And as far as anyone was concerned until we made this discovery, there was nothing in the middle. So, when we found something repeating every 18 minutes, I genuinely got goosebumps because it's just unprecedented. There's no model that fits this perfectly, and we just weren't expecting to see it.
So, are you calling it like a medium radio transient or something like that?
Yeah, we've had a few discussions on Twitter. Slow SAR is my leading favorite because it sounds a bit like pulsar, but slow SAR. Yeah, some people have said, what about slow radio burst? But then the thing is that this source repeats, and it repeats periodically, right? Like rhythmically. Whereas fast radio bursts, sometimes they repeat, but they don't seem to have a pattern to them.
What are rhythmic radio bursts?
Rhythmic radio bursts is cool. Yeah, RRBs. It sounds a little bit like a genre of music. So,
It's cool astronomy, right?
yeah, absolutely. Well, astronomy is where all the cool kids
Oh,
hang out.
exactly.
Yeah, so one of the reasons we haven't come up with a new fancy name for this, though, is that it does match the characteristics of a predicted object in some ways. So this is a little bit of a long story, but I'll try and keep it brief. So I mentioned pulsars earlier, and they're these magnetic rotating neutron stars. There's also hyper powerful pulsars with really insane magnetic fields. I mean, our pulsars are like 10 to the 14 Gauss. Magnetars are like 10 to the 16 Gauss. So they're just ridiculously magnetic. And we know that these exist because we see them in X-ray. So we actually, they're so powerful that they're emitting like hot X-rays. And we have noticed that some of the magnetars, which normally spin every 1 to 10 seconds, sometimes they go into outburst, they become very bright in the X-ray, and then for like a few weeks, a few months, a few years, they emit radio waves. And those radio waves are at the same period as the X-rays, so they're to do with them spinning. So our source is also producing radio waves, and if you try and use all the math for pulsars, it just doesn't quite work out. It shouldn't have enough energy to produce radio waves. But if it were a magnetar, then potentially the energy is not just coming from the spin, the energy could be coming from this like hyper powerful magnetic field. And indeed, people have predicted that there should be a class of objects called an ultra long period magnetar. And so that basically fits the facts about what we're seeing with this source.
So, how did you or your colleagues first pick up on the existence of this object?
Well, it's really a great story. So it has some parallels with the discovery of pulsars. So I'm running a big telescope project called the Galactic and Extragalactic All Sky MWA Extended Survey, or GLEAM-X, and it builds on some work I did about 5 years ago, producing a map of the sky in radio color. But this is a deeper survey, so we're returning to the same places in the sky multiple times. And we're trying to stack up all the images and make really deep observations of the sky. But I thought it would be a fun student project, since we're returning to the same place twice, to take those observations and subtract one from the other and look at things that change. So I don't know if you've seen the film Don't Look Up, but basically the opening credits, that was the setup, except in radio waves and with the genders swapped. I gave this project to a very capable undergraduate student, Tyrone O'Doherty, and for his honours year, so his final year of his undergrad here, he did this project where he compared pairs of observations and saw what changed. And he found a lot of artifacts and rubbish. He found this one super bright source that no testing, you know, it passed all the tests. We couldn't seem to get rid of it. It didn't seem to be a mistake. And as he finished up his honours year, you know, he wrote up that thesis, "I found a thing." And he went on to do a PhD with some colleagues on a different topic entirely. So yeah, at the beginning of 2021, I was like, well, I have this big survey to progress, but I'll have a look at this source and just see if it turns out to be anything interesting. And oh my goodness, was it interesting.
And so how did you and your colleagues react to this? It's a completely unexpected object.
Yeah, well, we were actually all working from home. So Perth had a couple of lockdowns in early 2021. And so we were kind of in the office, back out of the office, in the office, back out of the office. And so everything was super disrupted. So it was actually kind of a moment where, like, I think my husband had the kids for the day and I was able to just like focus on something that would completely distract me from the pandemic. And so I was working on this like at home and found that the signal wasn't just, you know, a really bright signal that had come and gone once, but that it was repeating. I posted it on Slack. And of course, you know, everybody else is looking for something to distract themselves. So we were just totally bananas. I went and upgraded our Slack plan so that we wouldn't lose any of the messages like right away, because we were just typing so much and so quickly, and everybody was checking archives and trying other telescopes and, you know, throwing out theories. Is it a flare star? Is it a weird pulsar? Is it a precessing pulsar? Is it aliens? And so we were, you know, tremendously excited about this, and really, like, genuinely, the excitement hasn't stopped. So it's still a big topic in the astronomy world, as well as, you know, it's been taken the general public by storm as well.
Yeah. I feel like that's a great new way to like gauge the level of a discovery, is like what level of Slack plan you have to practice.
Yeah, absolutely. Good job. We get the educational discount.
Yeah, exactly. So then how did you go on and investigate it? So, and did you have any ideas what it might be from the outset?
Yeah, well, I mean, I know I joke about people calling me and people emailing me saying, oh, it's aliens, you really should consider aliens. But like genuinely, one does consider aliens when you find a signal that's repeating in the radio band at a frequency, at a repetition rate that nobody's ever seen before. You genuinely consider that. And what was really spooky was the very first detection we made was at 154 megahertz, right? So the center of our frequency band. So it's where we're most sensitive to find things. And we made another detection when I started looking through the data. I was looking through to see if I could find just initially how it would change with frequency. I didn't expect it to change with time. And I didn't find anything in the other frequency channels until I picked it up again at 154 megahertz. And so my first experience was that this was a narrow signal, right? It was coming in at just one frequency. And of course, that is absolutely chilling, because that is one of the indicators that the search for extraterrestrial intelligence would use to discriminate between an artificial signal and a natural signal. It's very expensive to make a very, very wide band signal. It costs a lot of energy. If you tried to do it with a normal radio transmitter on Earth, it would just melt. Like, it takes power. So that's one of the things that we think aliens would do, is they would send out narrow band signals. Now, of course, I've already talked about it. I don't think it's aliens. Why? Because as I searched through the data, I started finding more instances. And the reason that the first two were at the same frequency was just that we were iterating through frequency channels, and we happened to be doing that every 20 minutes. And the source is 18 minutes period. So like the first time we found it, we just happened to have returned to the same frequency at the same time as the pulse switched on. The next time we found it was at a different frequency, and then again and again at different frequencies. So it's actually emitting over this very, very wide range of frequencies. And as I've said, the power involved would just be too tremendous to possibly be artificial. That as well, there's like nothing encoded in the data. There's no secret messages. It looks entirely natural. So that was one of the theories we considered. And immediately, like not immediately, there were a few hours there where I thought, do you call the prime minister? What do I do? Yeah, who would I tell? What was the procedure? And I, you know, Googling the there's actually like a document online about how to deal with first contact. Anyway, I didn't need the document. So there was that, and we discarded that. And then of course you have to consider lots of interesting astrophysical origins. So could it be something in an orbit? Like 18 minutes is a pretty tight orbit. That's pretty fast, but you can do it. And the orbital mechanics, you know, it's pretty quick equations to do. The whiteboard is full of equations. And you can work out that to put something in an 18-minute orbit, it has to be smaller than a star. If you try and put two normal stars in an 18-minute orbit, they smash into each other. It's not possible. So you have to use really compact objects like white dwarfs, neutron stars, black holes, exoplanets. But then you have a problem that there's actually no really good way of creating the kinds of emission that we saw. There's no good models that fit this. So that's why we ended up settling on a rotating model, where you just have a very compact object that's rotating, because it's at least reasonable to produce the kind of emission we're seeing.
And so what were your conclusions at the end of the whole process?
So the fact that the signal in our data is changing quite quickly. So we get these pulses that are like 30 to 60 seconds across, but sometimes there's these spiky bursts of less than half a second. That means the object is super compact. It's less than half a light second, probably much smaller in size. And that means that the object is very small. It must be less than half a light second across. And that basically means it's very compact, like it's a white dwarf, a neutron star, or a black hole. These are things that are left after stars of different masses explode and collapse and end their lives. It's also producing radio waves that are very polarized. So all the radio waves are like lined up. They're all coming in at the same angle. And that tells us in astrophysics that there are magnetic fields involved. And so that kind of dismisses the black hole possibility, because black holes don't produce very polarized radio emission. So that leaves us with white dwarfs and neutron stars. And it could be either, to be honest. The neutron star explanation is a little bit easier to understand, because neutron stars are basically invisible until you find them doing something weird. But then once they've stopped doing the weird thing, you can't find them anymore. Whereas white dwarfs are visible in optical and UV and infrared, and we've been looking at them for decades. So you'd think somebody would have noticed a white dwarf doing something like this before. And there is actually one white dwarf that does a kind of similar thing, but it's super, super faint. And it's not really clear why this, if it were a white dwarf, would be so bright. So there's a lot of different theories. And the fun thing is putting the discovery out there and listening to other astronomers get excited and put forward their theories. So that's kind of the next step at the moment.
That's the most sort of rewarding part of it all, isn't it? Just the once you've done your bit, you just release it into the ether and see what other people can come back at you with it, right?
Yeah, that's right. Like there's an interplay between observers. So I'm an observer. I try and understand the telescope, try and come up with new experiments, new ways of looking at the sky. We call it opening new parameter space. When you're looking at things in a different way, so you might find things that haven't been discovered before. And then write those in an intelligible way, make all the code and data available, and present that to the community. Then there's theorists who look at the observations that have been made and kind of try and fit them into what we understand about the universe. And you know, a good astronomer will have aspects of both, but I'm definitely more of an observer than a theorist. So of course I did all the back of the envelope calculations, but like detailed magnetohydrodynamic simulations of neutron star crusts is just not something that I'm an expert in. But fortunately there are whole communities who are gonna be doing that sort of thing while I turn my radio telescope back to the sky and search for more.
Well, that's a really great story. I saw this and I was so excited to talk about it, because it's a bit different to what would normally be out in the general news of astronomy. It's sort of this weird radio transient, unusual thing that, you know, for once isn't, people aren't going on about aliens about it.
Well, actually, everyone's talking about aliens.
I try to avoid it because it's because it's just not, it's like, it's not as interesting. It's just so much more interesting to talk about the process of it rather than what it could be, rather than speculating.
Yeah, I mean, I think we would all love for that to come true, for us to see aliens. But I guess, so I've had people who have said, oh, it's aliens. And I said, no, but really it's not. It's too, it would take too much energy to produce. And then they say, oh, well, maybe it's energy, it's aliens just using a lot of energy. And I'm like, but why? Why would you do that? Why would you simulate a source that looks entirely like a natural source? And so it's a kind of God of the gaps type philosophical problem, where you're so desperately invested in believing in aliens that everything is an alien. And if it looks just like a natural object, well, they're just pretending, and they're out there somewhere. And I mean, yeah, I'm sympathetic to wanting to, that, you know, have hold on to that belief. But like, I'm a scientist and I've got theories, you know, testable predictions, testable models of what this thing could be. And I look at the data that we have, and then I see, okay, which theory is supported best by the data. Mm-hmm. And I'm still not actually claiming that this is definitely an ultra long period magnetar. That's just the theory that best fits the data. And I'm totally, you know, I'm more than excited. I'm really like, I'd be thrilled if somebody out there says, oh, I've got an even better theory, or I found another one and it has these properties, and together we can work out what they are, and there's something that we haven't even imagined. That's great. That's how science works.
All right. Thank you, Natasha Hurley-Walker. That was a really, really great chat. Hopefully we'll be able to have you on again in the future. Thank you.
Love to, Cameron. Thanks for having me.